Welcome to another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic wine. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. If you're a red wine drinker, I recommend the Chateau Veronique. It's a nice, full-bodied red wine from France, made exclusively from organic grapes. Click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer from the Organic Wine Company just for Peter B. Collins listeners. Today's podcast is another installment in our continuing series, co-hosted by FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. We call it The Boiling Frogs. Stand by for a powerful interview about the failure of our war on drugs and what happened to a DEA agent who exposed wrongdoing to his superiors. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frog.
With Sybil Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins, and this is The Boiling Frogs. Our guest today is Sandalio Gonzalez. Currently, he's president of the Federal Hispanic Law Enforcement Officers Association and also is involved with the Law Enforcement Officers Advocates Council. He is a former DEA special agent in charge in various locations. He is a native of Cuba, started his career in law enforcement way back in 1972, at the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He went on to join the DEA in 1978, and he has served in a number of important capacities. In the 1980s, he was in San Jose, Costa Rica, where they say mucho gusto instead of de nada when you say thank you, and he was the assistant country attaché there. Then he was promoted to group supervisor in Mexico City, then assigned to the inspection division at DEA headquarters in Washington. Then he was promoted to advisor to the commander-in-chief of the Southern Command in Panama, where he served in the early 1990s. Then back to Washington, chief of the drug suppression session of the section of the Office of Cocaine Investigations. And in 1995, he took over as chief of the South America section in the Office of International Operations. And then he reported to the Miami Field Division as an assistant special agent in charge. And as we mentioned, he also was the special agent in charge in El Paso, Texas. Sandalio Gonzalez, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Well, thank you, Peter. Glad to be here, and thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. And Sybil Edmonds, why don't you tell us a little bit about Sandy Gonzalez's history, and we'll ask him to add in a little bit on that as well.
Surely. First of all, it's great to have you, Sandy. Sandy was one of the first members of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition when we set up several years ago, and he has been a very active member in pursuing the needed legislation in Congress, and he has brought in some very interesting background and even more interesting cases, both of them, both is the background, and also the cases have not really been covered by the mainstream media. Not unusual, as you know, with most of these important cases. And it's great to have him.
And Sandy Gonzalez, first, can I just take a stab at this? I guess that you bristle when you hear yourself referred to as a whistleblower. Tell me how you respond to that.
Well, it's not the proper term. I mean, that's what's been used for many, many years. But basically, a whistleblower is someone who is doing his or her job, doing what they're supposed to do, and all of a sudden they get they get labeled as a whistleblower, which has a negative connotation, no matter how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. And in the early part of this century, the area around 2004, you did your job, and I recited some of the details of your history and your assignments with the Drug Enforcement Agency so that our listeners would understand that you had a long history with this organization, and my guess is that you had confidence that when you reported to your superiors these two very different cases, one based in Miami about activities in Colombia and the other based in El Paso about murders in Juarez, Mexico, that you believed that your good faith reporting of these incidents would be properly received by your superiors.
Well, absolutely. These were very serious matters and that needed to be looked into. And they weren't.
And we'll get into the details of what happened to you and how you had to try to defend yourself and ultimately what I consider to be a small settlement you got from the federal government. But why don't we first talk about the Juarez case? Because many Americans know about the efforts by the Mexican government to crack down on the drug cartels. And that one of the perhaps unintended consequences is that the narco traffickers have gotten very militant themselves. And there is a huge list of people who have died, been killed, or simply disappeared as a result of the crossfire between the government and the drug kingpins, the cartels in Mexico. Could you give our listeners a quick sketch of that situation, and then we'll talk about the rather sordid story that that you reported to your superiors?
Well, the situation in Mexico between the government and the cartels has been going on for years. It's open to debate as to whether the government is fully fighting these people. When you listen to the informant in the House of Death case in Juarez, he gave an interview recently to Narco News, and he described the government and the cartel as being the same. As I said, that's open to debate.
Well, and that's not the only source, Sandy. A little bit later, I have a clip that I'm going to play from a journalist named Charles Bowden. And Chuck Bowden has published recently a cover story in Mother Jones magazine and also a very powerful account in Harper's magazine. And he certainly confirms those connections that you just alluded to.
Yes, I am aware of Chuck. I've met him several years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so tell our listeners what you found there and what you reported in Juarez.
Well, what happened in Juarez was that we came upon or discovered a situation where there was an informant who had been a DEA informant but had been deactivated and remained an informant for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who was involved with a cell of the Juarez cartel. Where they were basically doing away with their competition with people that didn't follow their way of doing business, whatever you want to call it, and they were bringing them into this house, pumping them for information through torture, and then killing them and burying them in the backyard of that house. And the way we learned of this was because during one of the torture sessions of three people that had been picked up in early January of 2004, one of the victims gave an address that led the bad guys to the house of a DEA agent and his family who were stationed in Juarez. And that led to a surveillance of the agent. It led to a traffic stop of the agent by the local police, who were in the payroll of the traffickers. And when all this unraveled, and we ended up having to bring out all of our personnel from Juarez into El Paso for safety reasons, and we started looking into the matter, and that's when we learned that these bodies were buried there, and there were like 12, I think, and a couple more were killed on the 14th or the 15th on the streets of Juarez. So it was a total of about 15 people that were murdered in connection with this particular house of death, as is now known. And we started looking into the matter as an investigation of a threat against DEA personnel. And this inquiry or investigation in trying to determine what happened, why this agent had been stopped by the police, and what went on afterwards, we learned of the informant's role. We learned of the murders. We learned that all this possibly could have been prevented if a different action had been taken by U.S. Personnel in the Homeland Security or ICE. And eventually, I ended up writing a letter to my counterpart and copy to the U.S. attorney in that district, the Western District of Texas.
Your counterpart in ICE?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that's the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency of the Department of Homeland Security.
Correct. And basically the letter was just looking for accountability, you know, trying to find out, hey, what happened, and, you know, who's accountable for this? You're accountable unless, basically the letter said, unless you come up with a valid explanation for all of this, all that happened, all these murders and whatever, I'm holding you responsible for this, because, the whole thing was pretty bad.
And let me just clarify a couple of things. This informant, a paid informant, was a Mexican national?
Yes.
Okay. And approximately 15 people were murdered by him, or by him and others, perhaps. And in one account that I read, Sandy, it was basically asserted that after the first murder, that his DEA handlers were aware of what he was doing, and they continued to pay him, continued to use him as an American informant, as he continued this killing spree. Is that correct?
Well, it was not his DEA handlers. It was his ICE handlers.
Okay.
As of today, I know I have no information to indicate that any DEA personnel were aware of what was happening at that time, and in order to allow him to continue. And also, to be fair, the informant that we know of so far was not involved in all 15 of the murders. He was involved, I think, by his own admission, in 4 or 5. He was involved in all of them, in the sense that, or all of them that took place in the house, in the sense that he was like the keeper of the house. He had like the key. And whenever they were going to use the house for a torture session or whatever, he would be called, and he would have to make the arrangements to have the house available when the people brought the victims into the house.
So, Sandy, at what point the retaliation started against you? And how?
Well, in this case, you have to understand there wasn't very much they could do. But what they could, they did. And basically, it was they took my evaluation for that year, and they knocked me down a couple of notches and made some comments about me exercising extreme poor judgment in writing this this letter, and which was something that that I fought against, and I took it to the Merit Systems Protection Board as retaliation for whistleblowing. And eventually we reached a settlement on that angle.
Now, Sandy, as you know, we have been covering the mainstream media and the lack of real reporting and investigative journalism. And this is one of those cases. And I know you have dealt with the mainstream media on this case. And I know there's been some very, very tiny little coverage of the case, the House of Death. But nobody has really covered the case except, of course, for Bill Conroy of Narconews, the alternative media. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your experience with the mainstream media in this case.
Well, my experience is that I've spoken to a number of reporters from several newspapers and magazines, and the bottom line is that those that decided to cover this, they covered the aspect of the murders. They did not. They never went into the cover-up that followed, and the fact that no one has been held accountable, and that the cover-up reached you know, all the way to Washington and the department level and Congress and you know, perhaps even higher. That even though we discussed it during our interviews, that has never been the focus of the media coverage of this case, with the exception of Narco News.
Correct. One example, a specific example, is the Newsweek magazine. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I informed one of the reporters for Newsweek of this case, and went into detail with it, and basically he told me that his editor had told him that this story would be much better, would get better coverage in a newspaper than in a national magazine, and they sort of blew it off. So, I mean, I don't know what it would take to get their attention.
And, Sandy, as far as the Congress, you briefly mentioned going to Congress. I know you and I had several meetings in Congress. In fact, we met with the appropriate committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right.
And this was one of the cases we discussed in details with some of their high-level staff. And some interesting stuff started happening. Do you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. We, well, not we. Sibel made arrangements for us to meet with the staff, senior staff of Senators Grassley and Leahy, I believe. That was back in 2005, in late 2005. And myself, Professor Bill Weaver, and Sibel met with, I think it was three or four people, staffs of both senators, and basically we spent like 3 hours with them. I think it was that long, and told them details, the whole thing, as far as this issue in Juarez, and also the issue of the of the alleged serious corruption in the embassy in Bogota, outlined in the memo by Thomas Kent, an attorney in the Justice Department. And basically, we heard nothing back from those people. Never heard from them again.
something very interesting happened. In fact, they brought in, and I believe it was Senator Leahy's office, they brought in this attorney from the Justice Department who was supposed to be a liaison attorney between the Justice Department and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And this was a surprise to us because that presented a major conflict of interest. Sandy, do you remember that incident?
Oh, absolutely. She played devil's advocate the entire time. And she did tell me or tell us who she was and where she came from, which I thought was nice of her to do. I mean, she was basically on loan, according to her, on loan to the senator's staff from the Executive Office of United States Attorneys in the Justice Department, which is the office that oversees and supports all the United States attorneys throughout the nation, which was a total conflict of interest because she knew personally the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Texas, whom we were talking about. And of course, you know, the Justice Department oversees the DEA, and, you know, it was just so inappropriate. But, you know, what can you do? I mean, that's what happened. It is what it is.
Yeah, that is the state of our Congress.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sandy, you referenced the Kent memo and the allegations of very serious corruption of DEA officers assigned in Bogota, Colombia. We have this well-known Plan Colombia, which involved the transfer of very large amounts of money in the billions of dollars from the U.S. Treasury to the central government in Colombia. And many Americans know that there's been an ongoing civil war there with the FARC. And there's also another group, which is an armed militant group that engages in narco-trafficking. And, of course, cocaine is the primary drug export of Colombia. Tell us about the Kent memo and how you responded to the information that you received.
Well, the Kent memo, I didn't have anything to do with it in the sense that he wrote, Thomas Kent is a trial attorney for the Justice Department, the wiretap unit in Washington. And he was within the narcotics and dangerous drug section. And he came upon this information that he felt was credible enough or important enough to report in an official memorandum to his chief, a lady by the name of Jody Avergan, who I believe held the rank of senior executive as a section chief. And it's amazing because when you see what this man wrote, and the fact that there was no action taken, it's really flabbergasting. He reported that through several unrelated investigations, a number of alleged corrupt agents in the DEA had been identified. He reported that an OIG, Office of Inspector General Investigator, had been assigned to the case and then removed. He asked to speak personally to the Public Integrity Section to ensure that his allegations were fully investigated and acted upon. And none of this happened. I mean, then he went into detail into, I believe, three or four specific allegations. Two of those I was familiar with because they had been made by subordinates of mine in Miami when I was in Miami. And basically, as far as I know, nothing happened, or if something happened, it was quickly covered up. The lady that the memo was written to left the Justice Department and went to DEA to become the executive assistant to the head of DEA, to the administrator. And they had both worked together at the Justice Department. So with the knowledge of this, of what was in this memo, this lady went over to DEA to work as the executive assistant to the administrator, and nothing happened. It's it's just amazing.
Now, Sandy, could you take a moment here and talk about the tension that is present in a law enforcement agency? On the one hand, there's what some people refer to as the blue wall, and that is that one officer never snitches on another, almost no matter what. The other side that produces tension is that as a sworn peace officer, you've sworn to uphold the Constitution and to enforce the laws of the United States. So when you see lawbreaking, whether it's a drug dealer, a narco trafficker, or somebody inside your own agency, you're essentially a mandated reporter where you're not supposed to turn a blind eye. You're not supposed to permit a cover-up to occur, and you could be penalized if you did. So talk about how you navigate the political minefield of a major law enforcement agency where you are at the very highest levels and where you are essentially caught between the blue wall and your obligation to your oath of office.
In short, it's very difficult. it's just something that eats at you. In my case, I did it. I had to do this. The issues were just too serious to even attempt to overlook. And it's a difficult thing to do because you realize and you understand that most of the people that you're working with just don't want anything to do with this, and they wish it would go away. And to give you an example, in the case in Miami where we had an issue of 10 missing kilograms of cocaine, when I went to the United States Attorney's office and talked to the section chief and informed them that I had to report this, this person looked at me and says, "Now, why do you have to go and do that? That's going to create a lot of problems."
Hmm. Yeah. So inconvenient.
Yeah. With this mindset, it's, you know, you basically become an outsider once you do this. People look at you, they tolerate you, but they don't like it.
And, Sandy, one thing I'm not clear on is the sequence of events here. Did the Juarez case surface before the Kent memo and the Miami/Bogota issues?
The Kent memo was dated December 19th of 04.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when he probably got so fed up that he had to put it in writing. These issues had taken place before that. Yeah, because he talks about ongoing cases at the time. So all of these cases were, you know, reported, or all these things happened before that date.
And so as you looked at these two very separate cases where you were reporting to superiors, did you hesitate the second time? Did you say, "Wow, I just got burned. And now I'm in another pickle. What am I going to do?"
Well, let me clarify that I had nothing to do with reporting the stuff that Kent did.
Mm-hmm.
He did that. I just happened to be aware of, I think, two of those cases because they involved subordinates of mine in Miami.
I see.
Okay.
So you were aware of it, but you weren't central to that issue.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I became aware of, I forget now how or when, but I did read the Kent memo at some point and recognized the cases that my people were working on. And then, of course, I discussed it with them and whatever. The issue in Juarez, that surfaced in January 14th of 2004.
I see. So 04 was quite a year for you.
Oh, absolutely. It was.
And if our listeners would like more information, you can go to the website 123realchange.blogspot.com. That's 123realchange.blogspot.com. And there's more information on the issues here related to Sandy Gonzalez. You're listening to The Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins. Sibel?
Yes, Sandy. Well, in Kent Memo, we are dealing with these corrupt agents. And in the House of Death case, we are dealing with this informant, the Mexican informant, who was on the payroll and participated in these atrocities. Then there is this other no-no areas that nobody really wants to report on, and many people don't know much about. And that is when we deal with cases, DEA deals with cases and sets up operations, and agencies such as the CIA and the State Department, they step in, and they interfere with the operations, and in many cases, they ruin them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I think you're a little bit familiar with the case of the Horn case.
Richard Horn.
Well, basically, what happens is that DEA is assigned overseas to work drug investigations. But drug investigations are not really the priority of the U.S. government in foreign countries. It's usually, you know, intelligence activities and the like. So when the two collide, usually the intelligence activity wins out over the drug investigation, and that's where a lot of these problems come in, and that's exactly what happened in the Horn case. He was doing
things. Well, we had our share over here. We had the Iran-Contra scandal, and even to date, after all the quasi-investigations and the slight publicity that it received, many people still consider it a conspiracy theory. They don't even believe that it actually took place.
What, the Iran-Contra thing?
Yeah.
Well,
and in particular, that the planes that went to Central America with weapons for the Contras did not come back empty, but came back with shipments of cocaine.
Well, I mean, I've had informants tell me, you know, what happened, how they did that stuff. The issue is that we weren't working these cases at the time. I recall passing some leads to our office in Guatemala at the time, to an agent named by the name of Celi Castillo, who did some investigation, who did follow some of those leads, and eventually paid dearly for it. But that's the nature of the overseas environment. It's not law enforcement is not top priority overseas.
And, Sandy, in some of our previous interviews with whistleblowers, one of the issues that's become very clear is that there are real problems with interagency cooperation and even communication. In our first interview with James Bamford about the NSA, what he has documented is that the NSA was tapping Osama bin Laden's satellite phone. They had the number. They knew he was calling this safe house in Yemen. Yet they didn't share that information with the FBI or the CIA. And Michael Scheuer at CIA, who's a bit of a wild man in some respects, he tried to get cooperation from NSA, and they refused. So he was able to set up a CIA monitoring of one side of those telephone calls. But he couldn't get both sides. And even when he sent a transcript of the side that he had intercepted over to NSA, they wouldn't supply him with the rest of the intercepts that they had. So that's just one example. Can you give us some idea of the level of cooperation and the level of conflict that you find, particularly when you're posted outside the country?
You know, I have to reiterate what I said earlier, that drug investigations are not the priority. So when we, let's say we're doing a narcotics investigation of whoever, if that person happens to be an asset or cooperating individual of an intelligence agency, somehow we have to drop what we're doing and go work on somebody else. That's usually how that goes. So it's a conflict. We have a conflict out there. I'm not sure that there is a solution for it. I've just never seen anyone try to solve that issue. It's sort of like in the domestic arena. Ever since the creation of DEA, which DEA was created by executive order, and then it was that order was codified into law, and stating that the DEA was the or is the premier agency, in charge of all drug enforcement efforts of the U.S. government. The back then the U.S. Customs Service really never accepted that, and we had ongoing battles over, who should handle what case or who had jurisdiction or, who was better than who had the better informants and, informant stealing, case stealing, things like that. They're still with us. They're still with us. When the FBI was given drug enforcement authority by Congress in the early 80s, same thing. Then it was DEA, Customs, and FBI battling for the cases and who would get the best case and get the press coverage and things like that. So I don't believe that has changed much, if at all. And then we continue with that same ailment of non-cooperation. And it's not good. I mean, the only people that win are the bad guys.
Well, we spend billions of dollars, Sandy, on this our so-called war on drugs. And you're talking about billions and billions of dollars. And I want to go back again to the point where I was referring to the cases where other agencies, not only that they don't cooperate, they actually interfere and damage ongoing important DEA operations, investigations, and not only, overseas, here in the United States, too. And when you have situations like this, as DEA agents, do you automatically just back off because, this is like a hands-off kind of a, let's say, unwritten policy? Or do you take it, who do you take it to? Do you take it to the Congress?
Well, no, these things don't reach that high because somehow they are resolved somehow at the if not at the agency head level, maybe at the deputy agency head level. It doesn't go much farther than that. Sometimes, like for example, when we couldn't agree on a memorandum of understanding at the agency level, then it was raised. At the agency level, then it was raised to the department level where, deputy attorney generals and deputy secretaries of whatever it was, I think it was Treasury at the time, now it's DHS, they would try to solve the issue.
And when you say solve the issue, Sandy, has there been any cases, let's say, with conflicts that involve either the CIA or State Department, with the DEA, has there been any cases where it has been resolved to the advantage or for the cause of the DEA, or has it been mainly one-sided, meaning their area overrides the DEA, the war on drug area, at any cost?
Well, like I said earlier, in the overseas arena, drug enforcement is not priority, is not above the intelligence issue, or the above, the intelligence function of the of the government. So it's been my experience that whenever we had an issue of with an investigation, it was more than likely settled in favor of the intelligence side than the law enforcement side.
I understand, but when we say overseas, Sandy, and then when we talk about the war on drugs here, I don't know even how we can separate this, because let's take the Afghanistan and the heroin, okay? Let's say what's happening in Afghanistan between the DEA and the CIA and the State Department, okay? Then we are talking about the same heroin. A certain percentage of it ends up here in the United States. So even though the conflict may occur over there, the result of it ends up affecting the Americans here in the United States. So how can we separate those conflicts as overseas over there, so that, okay, sometimes, or in most cases, they interfere, you know, one operation with the intelligence operations, and not consider it in a more macro level and say, and as a result, that basically nullifies our war on drugs here. Because this drug enters here, so you know, it enters the United States.
Well, first of all, there is no war on drugs, and there never has been. That's just a buzz phrase.
Perfect, and that's the point I wanted to get at. Please tell us a little bit about this.
Well, you know, you don't wage a war. First of all, you don't wage war against a substance. Anyway.
Very good.
Well, how can you say that? We've been waging war against a tactic.
Yes.
And next we'll take on bad shoes or something, you know?
Yeah. Usually when you go to war, you kind of give the warriors the tools to win. That was never the case with law enforcement. I think the war on drugs was declared, but I don't think the budgets of the agencies were raised in any substantial way. I think over the years, budgets did come up because, you know, nothing ever gets cheaper, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in essence, and the effort was so fragmented, too. At one point, we brought in the Department of Defense to support law enforcement, and they got, I don't know what it was, $1 point some billion, you know, So the effort was fragmented. Instead of giving that money to the agencies that had the authority to arrest people and to prosecute them, they gave it to an agency or to a department that could only support with detection and monitoring, you know, of ships and planes. You talk about waste. Then you have, for example, we had an operation in South and Central America where we were supposed to attack the source, in South America, the source of the drugs, and in Central America,
the trafficking?
The transshipment? The transshipment, there you
mm-hmm.
go. So the equipment that we had were helicopters from the Vietnam era, you know, single engine things that could, you know, break at any minute and fall and crash. And we had cheap equipment. I mean, we couldn't get good equipment. We couldn't get Blackhawks, you know. When you see that level of effort or lack thereof, then you say this is not a war. That's why it was a political buzz phrase that was used to give the appearance that we were really going after this when we really weren't. We were just like holding the line and just doing what we always did, you know, arrest a few people, prosecute them, and we were good at it. You know, DEA is outstanding group of guys. They know what they do. They know, you know, they know how to do what they're supposed to do.
Sandy, one more question about Afghanistan, because Richard Holbrooke, quasi-ambassador, announced this week that we are shifting our approach. And he said that we are going to move away from crop suppression and amp up our interdiction efforts. And by way of an example, they gave us a photo op of an opium/heroin warehouse that they had discovered and busted up. Now, I find this curious on a number of levels. One is, if you're going to deal with a drug problem like this, you have to hit it at every level. Crop suppression cannot be your only tool. And so it seems, I don't want to say amusing, but odd, that we are only now discovering that there are warehouses, some of which allegedly relate to the brother of President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan. And it strikes me that this is just another diversion to make it look like we are taking meaningful steps to curb the export of opium products from Afghanistan, when in fact it's an illusion because we don't control the country, we don't control the warlords, and we certainly don't have a handle on the elements that are broadly referred to as the Taliban in the U.S. media.
Well, and it's much harder to find a load of drugs once it's been processed and hidden and given to transshippers or whatever than it is if you have all the information on where these plants are being grown and where you can go destroy them. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but once the drug is processed and put into kilogram packages and whatever, and given to the and put in the transshipment route, it's difficult to interdict unless you have specific human intelligence that tells you where the drugs are. So I don't see how they can even try to say that this new step is going to be more successful than attacking, than destroying the plants.
I have to step in again here because when we are looking at the Afghanistan situation, and when we look at their GDP, and when you look at the percentage of that GDP's dependency on the opium, on heroin, and when we look at the fact that this is our government installed there, the central government, I'm not talking about the warlords, and as far as the transporting and processing the rest of this opium product goes, and when you look at the countries involved, other allies we have in Central Asia, and then, of course, Turkey, I don't see any reason, I don't see any justification to say that what the United States government is telling us about wanting to eradicate, to destroy, to reduce this opium production, the heroin production, because it just doesn't make sense. Logically, it doesn't make sense, because that would ensure the collapse of the government, our government in Afghanistan, Karzai's government. This is why we're talking about Karzai's own brother. So I think that is the level that we should be looking at, and the mainstream media, rather than the technicalities of maybe how difficult it is or what are the chances of our successes in doing that, when it's one story and the reality on the ground, what's happening in Afghanistan, is a totally different story. Please disagree with me. If you do, please let us know.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. it's in a way it's similar to the producing countries in Latin America.
Correct. And tell us about that, Sandy.
Well, how do you get Colombia or Peru or Bolivia to get rid of the coca plant when that's the livelihood of their people there in those areas? There's no other crop that they can grow that'll make them as much money. So they don't grow anything else. And so, what is the solution? Buy them out. I guess we could try buying their crops and destroying them ourselves, but I don't know how that would work.
So why the pretense then? Why this war on drug and billions of dollars? Why the pretense?
Because It's all, you know, I'm thinking of a quote by George Carlin here. You know, BS is the glue that holds us together here. Something like that. He said something like that.
Well, it's like one segment of Americans is consuming drugs and the other's consuming propaganda about drugs.
Yeah.
Well said,
good.
Peter.
And, Sandy, with this in mind, what you just described, let me play a brief excerpt here from my conversation with reporter Chuck Bowden, because in just a few sentences, he summarizes this situation in relation to Mexico. I'm talking with Charles Bowden. Read his article. It's powerful stuff in the new Mother Jones July-August 09 edition. And Chuck Bowden, as I look at this, I believe that the militarization of drug policy has been an utter failure. Obama's new drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, the former police chief from Seattle, is trying to step back from the language, the militarization language of drug policy. But it seems that we've kind of missed the boat here, because the situation in Mexico seems to be beyond a point of no return. That these drug cartels are so heavily armed and have dominance over key geographic areas, and with the amounts of money involved, the bribery opportunities there, as you point out in your article, have made the military riddled with unreliable people and those who have a personal, selfish agenda. So do you see a way out of this with most of the weapons, the automatic weapons in particular, coming from the United States? Most, of course, of the product is being sold in the United States. This really seems to be an intractable set of issues that threatens the stability of the government of Mexico.
And yes, in two ways. Look, the what we've done for 40 years in the United States is take what at most is a public health issue, drug use, and turn it into a criminal issue. We've created an empire of prisons, narcotics officers, and agencies. What's happened in Mexico is that they become dependent on the money, and I'll give their listeners an easy example. The number one source of foreign currency in Mexico through exports is oil. Number two officially is the remittances sent by illegal Mexicans in the United States, the money they send home,
right,
which is $23 billion. Number three is tourism and then agriculture. This is all malarkey. Look, at the drug industry sends $30 to $50 billion of hard currency a year home to Mexico. The budget of the Mexican military, the army, which is about 250,000 people, is about $4 to $5 billion a year. DEA, by its own analysis, in 1995, which, you know, was a little ways back in time, figured the Juarez cartel alone was taking in $250 million a week. That the big money is in drugs. If you magically could stop Americans from purchasing these interesting South American products, if you could just magically seal the border, Mexico would collapse.
So that is a stunning statement in less than 3 minutes about the ramifications of our efforts to criminalize, militarize drug policy, and in particular the monster that we've created at our southern border. And certainly, Sandy Gonzalez, you are more intimately aware of this than I am as an observer from a distance. What would you add to Chuck Bowden's comments there?
I don't think I can add very much, if anything. I agree with what he said. One interesting thing, just to add to that, I guess, is the federal... The federal effort for us to try to get people away from drugs, it's almost non-existent. I'm trying to think of the name of the program. Demand reduction. The demand reduction effort of DEA was almost non-existent. So. At least at the federal level, we're doing little or nothing to help our youth stay away from drugs or not get into drugs in the first place, and reduce the demand. So that would be a good question to pose to some of these politicians that that oversee the budgets of the DEA, of the ONDCP, and the like. Because I always thought that was kind of backwards.
And anything else you'd like to add from your observations, from your experience in El Paso, about the U.S.-Mexican problems related to drugs and the high-powered automatic weapons that are being smuggled in from the U.S.?
Well, the smuggling in from the U.S., I suppose some of that goes on, but Bill Conroy wrote an article about how a lot of these weapons are exported legally to Mexico with State Department licenses.
Really?
He did some background on it, called the State Department, and they acknowledged that they issue so many licenses a year and so many weapons go to Mexico, and guess who, according to the law, guess who gets the weapons in Mexico when they get there, who handles them and stores them and keeps them and all that?
Well, I would imagine they go to the military and then are stolen out by the cartels.
There you go. You got it right.
and maybe stolen was the wrong verb. Perhaps they are fenced out by underpaid soldiers whose only way to buy a flat-screen TV or a new car is to sell some of these weapons to the drug trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a very telling piece of information that Bill put together on that issue.
Now, Sandy, I'd like to turn back to your own case, and I confess that it was only recently in a podcast with Sabell that I learned about this murky group or agency called the Merit Systems Protection Board. And they are established by, I believe, an act of Congress to evaluate the situation when somebody becomes a quote-unquote whistleblower, and they are either sanctioned or lose their job as a result. Tell us about your own experience in pursuing your claims of wrongful termination at the MSPB.
Well, first of all, before you get to the MSPB, you have to go through a process where you present your complaint to an outfit called the Office of Special Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And when they kiss you off, which is almost automatic, then you can file an appeal with the Merit Systems Protection Board. And it's a very bureaucratic process. It should be easy, but it isn't. Any employee who lacks legal advice when he or she goes through these administrative proceedings is surely going to lose. I mean, they lose anyway because the record of the U.S. Merit System Protection Board ruling in favor of employees and against the government is dismal. It's somewhere in the 90-some percentile against employees. So it's kind of like a farce, you know. They're there, but, they're like the administrative judges are, with few exceptions, are almost all rubber stamp for the government. So that there's really very little protection for the employee. I was not terminated, by the way. I want to clarify that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You resigned or retired?
I retired. Yes. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was given a negative evaluation, which I took through the system. By that time, I knew the system a little bit and was able to resolve it with a settlement, and besides, the Merit Systems Protection Board does not quote unquote protect people in intelligence agencies or the FBI although I think there's some legislation, and Sibel probably knows more about this than I do, that some recent legislation that perhaps now covers those employees.
And before we get to that, Sibel does want to raise that. You were awarded a settlement of just under $400,000, and after legal fees and your expenses, that seems to be a drop in the bucket for what you, I think, should be paid for the way your career ended in a manner that is well out of bounds.
Well, I'm satisfied. I never went at this for the money. It was more the principle of the thing. I'm not unhappy about the way things turned out.
Okay.
My case went to a jury, and basically the jury found that I was telling the truth and that the government was not. And to me, that was a great victory. Anything else that came was icing on the cake.
Right. Let's go back to our dirtiest topic, Sandy. Congress and the new administration. The bill that you were talking about, the legislation, we already know that the White House is set to veto it. So that is the inclusion of the agencies such as the FBI and the Department of Defense and the CIA, et cetera.
So the Obama White House is going to veto it?
Absolutely. They tried to attach it to another bill a few months back. And
the stimulus bill, a must-pass bill.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that is actually the topic that I wanted to talk about a little bit and have you give us your take on the new administration, especially after we spent together fighting these cases and fighting for the real accountability for the wrongdoers within these agencies, and of course to get our real needed legislation, not the whitewash legislation, the lame ones that they passed, the decorative legislation on whistleblowers protection. And we kind of were very hopeful. In 2006, in November, we said, okay, we got rid of our major obstacle, the Republicans, because that's what we were told. So they're gone. Now we have the people that we considered friends because they made a lot of promises, many promises to us. And we didn't see any change. 2007, 2008, and here we are, mid to 2009. And the same thing with the administration. We thought that things were being blocked by pressure from the White House. It was mainly President Bush and Dick Cheney. And we have not seen any difference. It's been, granted, only 5-6 months, but no difference whatsoever in the new administration. And in fact, we are being told that, and these are by our sources in the Congress, that in fact we have even less chance now to get a real bill, real protection for whistleblowers. Tell us your take on this, both in terms of Congress and their abdication of their oversight responsibility, and a little bit of your take on the new administration.
Well, it's a huge disappointment. The new administration, in many ways, if not in all ways, having to do with these employment issues and whistleblower issues and the like are like a rubber stamp for the Bush administration. In fact, on the issue of the informant in the House of Death, who is now in custody awaiting deportation to Mexico, the Obama administration has taken the same line as the Bush administration, which is to try to deport him so that he can be killed in Mexico after an immigration judge ruled in his favor that he should not be sent to Mexico. So they're basically, in a, quote, legal way, unquote, trying to get him killed, which is, reprehensible. I mean, So that's really, you know, that's my take on these people. Congress the same, I mean, the same way. I mean, these guys that you were talking to, and I think I talked to a couple of them myself when they became the majority. They never answer the phone again. I mean, what do you do with people like that when you realize that these are the people that are running the government?
And with the mainstream media that refuses to do its job.
Yeah, the free press is not free.
Well said, Sandy. Peter?
Sandalio Gonzalez, thank you very much for joining us today. Former special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, now president of the Federal Hispanic Law Enforcement Officers Association. And you can also you can Google them to find them on the web. And also he is involved with the Law Enforcement Officers Advocates Council. And their website is advocatescouncil.us. Sandy Gonzalez, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Sandy. Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until then.